Okay, good morning. Monday morning, 9:12. All right, so we're in the home stretch here. This is our last week and last week of actual classes. Next week is supposed to be finals week. And I thought a little bit about what I wanted to do today, and we had started that lab, which was the oxidation reduction scheme. And I think that we can, I was thinking maybe we'd look at that a little bit, but you know what? I'm kind of done with it. I think that it's more important to spend time supporting things for lecture and getting some practice in for the lecture component and these SN1, SN2, E1, E2s. And so I'd like to give you guys as much time this week as we can to practice. And I think that that means that we could do some active sort of stuff this morning. So I've got some problem sets that rather than just putting up a problem set, I think that what we can do is we can sort of work through these problem sets. We'll do them one at a time. We'll put them up on the screen and we'll kind of walk through the problems. And I'm going to try not to be redundant with lecture. So I'm going to do the same thing in lecture, but I'll do it with different problems within lecture. So that you get a wider view of sort of what's going on and how to tackle these. The SN1, SN2, E1, E2 problems, when you start to try to figure out which direction the reaction goes, takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of, it just takes a lot of time of going through and looking at a lot of problems and learning how to use the different resources that you've got. So I think that that's what I want to start doing this morning is share with you how we tackle some of those problems. And we'll do the same thing in lecture, and I'll do the same thing in the afternoon lab. And I think we'll pick that up on Wednesday and do even more of it on Wednesday and give you guys even more diverse problems and lots more practice and just try to get some of this practice done in class in that way. So let's pick it up with that. And I'm going to pull some problem sets up. Oh, and as I pull these up, I also want to share with you, why can't I get to that? There we go. Also want to share with you the magic sheet and be able to go back and forth with that magic sheet in different problem types and showing you different things. So let me bring that in first off. And airdrop this into our discussion. And I think this should bring in multiple pages. Although it doesn't seem to have. Oh, it dropped it in way down here. Interesting. Okay, that's all right. It can stay down here. This is the magic sheet that has the different reactions, SN2, E2, SN1, E1. And they're set up in this way because SN2 and E2 compete with each other. And so we have here substrate, solvent, nucleophile, leaving group, temperature, and the different things that will promote the SN2 versus what will promote the E2 reaction. And we do the same for SN1 and E1. Same list of topics or same list of components, and then the SN1 versus E1. And I just have a little quote up here that I like a lot, which is that the characteristic reaction of an alkyl halide or alkyl tosylate with a Lewis base is elimination. Special conditions are required to promote substitution. And so most of the time what we see is that within these reactions, the tendency leans or favors towards elimination, and that special conditions are required to promote substitution. And what we'll see is that within those substitutions, that it's primarily that we're looking at primary substrates that are going to promote substitution. and that in the other cases, as we go to tertiary and secondary, we lean more towards elimination. What's interesting to note is that when we look at this SN2, that SN2 has benzyl, allele, methyl, that these sort of substrates will have to draw what benzyl, allele, and methyl look like, and we'll get to those. But primary is way faster than secondary. Notice tertiary isn't even on the list here. When I go to E2, it's the opposite, tertiary, secondary, primary. SN1, E1, because they go through carbocations, they also have the tertiary as being the fastest, and then decrease down to secondary and down to primary. So really it's the SN2, which is unique, which has the primary substrate being the fastest in SN2. And then we have some solvent issues, some nucleophile issues, leaving group, temperature. And on the back side of this, on the second page, we have classifications of nucleophiles, whether a nucleophile is very good, good, fair, weak, very weak, and those different types of nucleophiles and where they fit. Some actual nucleophilicity constants up against pKa's, so that you can see that pKa and nucleophilicity don't trend together. And then different solvents, which are bimolecular promoting solvents. These are polar solvents. And then solvents which promote ionization, and these are our polar protic solvents. So what we're going to do is we're going to take each problem, and then we'll bounce back and forth with the magic sheet, and we'll try to classify each thing as we look at it on the magic sheet. And then we'll try to come up with a direction of where we think the reaction is going. Is the reaction going SN1, SN2, E1, E2? And try to get a sense of where the reaction goes. So let's start off with the first one. I'm going to go back up to the beginning of the notes, and we'll draw out our first reaction. And let's do this with sodium hydroxide in acetonitrile. And what we'll normally do is look at how we set up the reaction. This is either the base or nucleophile that gets written above the arrow. The substrate is always the material that we're working on, the reactant. We have the solvent and whatever temperature conditions the reaction requires. And so we're going to make a list. We're going to make a list of substrate. Let's go down and grab substrate, solvent, nucleophile, leaving group, temp. Substrate, nucleophile, leaving group, solvent, and temperature. And then we're going to try to classify each one of these things out as we look at the chemical reaction and figure out where these groups are sort of leaning. Okay, and we're using some abbreviations here that we're also going to have to get used to seeing and using. So the substrate, what we want to know, is it primary, secondary, or tertiary in terms of where the leaving group is? So where is that leaving group? Is that leaving group on a primary position, a secondary position, or a tertiary position? Remember, you can use the chat to throw things in there to me so that I know that everything's going okay and that you guys are following along. As we look at the leaving group here is the tosylate. And the structure of the tosylate when we look at what that structure of that leaving group is, tosylates have a structure where they're an oxygen connected to a sulfur, connected to an aromatic ring system. And this is what we call OTS. And it's a very good leaving group. And when we look at its position at the carbon that it's attached to, the carbon that we're concerned with is that carbon right there. And that carbon puts us on a primary substrate. And in terms of primary substrate, this is a primary tosylate. So when we go down and we look at the magic sheet and we see sort of where that fits in, we're looking at a primary group. That is not a highlighter. We're looking at primary group. And so where does primary fit in? There's no primary on that one. There's primary on this one. But in terms of how this is looking, this is the slowest for an E2 reaction. This is the slowest for an E1 reaction. Primary not on the list. And here, we're not the fastest, but we're pretty darn fast in terms of SN2 reaction. So that primary substrate is leaning towards SN2. As I come back up here, this primary tosylate is leaning towards an SN2 reaction. My leaving group, we can go back and we can classify the tosylate. So I know, I'm sorry, there's no other way to do this but bouncing around screens quite a bit. What I want to find is a leaving group. And in terms of leaving group, did I list leaving groups? I did. Leaving groups are listed here. So, and this doesn't help a whole lot, but what we see is that sulfonates, this is our tosylate, is what we call a sulfonate. A sulfonate is something that has the oxygens and some R group attached to it. This is a sulfonate. Should have been, I can't go in and erase that. It's too tight in there. It should have been sulfonate. So we're sulfonate, which is the best sort of leaving group that you can have. However, when you look at all of these different reactions, sulfonate, they all have the same ranking. But in terms of the leaving group, they all have the similar sort of leaving group. And that's not helping me decide between SN2, E2, E1, SN1. So when I look at the leaving group here, the leaving group is not really helping me in this regard. They're all the same. Solvent. Let's look at solvent real quick. Solvent is the acetonitrile. The structure of this solvent is a CH3 group with a carbon and a triple bond to a nitrogen. And this is called acetonitrile. When I look at the solvent, it doesn't have any protic hydrogens on it. It's polar in that I have a strong dipole moment from the acetonitrile group. Let's go and look and see where it shows up on the magic sheet. It's going to be down here in solvents. And it's here. So there's my acetonitrile. And these are solvents which promote SN2 and E2. So this solvent is really supporting SN2 and E2 reactions. So let's go back and mark that out. That this is an SN2 E2 solvent. Temperature, 60 degrees. Where that's sitting, is that high or low? We haven't really talked about that yet in class. What we have talked about is when we were at heat, that this equals boiling point of solvent. And we always think of that as high. But what is high and what is low depends upon the leaving group. When I think about a leaving group, I think about a game that, I am not good at my drawing today. I think about a game that is like a paddleball game. And I think about a ball attached at the end of a string where you're going to hit this thing and the amount of heat is relative to the amount of force that you were going to use to hit the ball with. So heat equals force. And the string represents the strength of the bond. That is proportional to how good the leaving group is. So, two sort of pictures here. One picture is a really good leaving group. In a good leaving group, what I have is sort of a bigger ball and a very flimsy string. And on the other side, what I have is, that did not work out so well. What happened there? It got all tweaky. Okay, let's try that one more time. Okay, this time what I've got is a little tiny ball, and it's connected by a much heavier string. So now this is a poor leaving group. And this is a small ball and strong string. So how does this relate to temperature? Well, what you're trying to do is you're trying to break the string. And so here, low temps, things that might even be somewhere around room temperature, 25 degrees Celsius, might actually be high. And so what is high and what is low? I would say that in this case, high might be greater than 25 degrees C and low less than 25 degrees C. That's just a rough approximation. On the other side, in order to break that string, in order to hit that with enough force, in order to actually cause that string to break, because there's not very much mass in the ball and strong, and the string is really strong, that a high temperature might be refluxing or something in the hundreds, or like around greater than 100 degrees C. And low might be something that is less than 100 degrees C. And so what is high and what is low is relative to the leaving group and is complicated to assess unless you can actually assess what the strength of your leaving group is. So when we look at the 60 degrees, is 60 degrees high or low? We had one of the best leaving groups we could have. So I would say that this temperature is kind of high. So as I look at this, the assessment here is that I have a tosylate and that this is a very good leaving group. And so 60 degrees is relatively high. And the last thing that we have in here is nucleophile. And the nucleophile is hydroxide ion. The sodium is the counter ion. So here what we have is a hydroxide ion, which is our nucleophile. And this could be a base as well. So we'll put it in there, nucleophile/base. And we can go back and we can look at what it says about nucleophiles. What it says in nucleophiles is that I need to have a good nucleophile, weaker base than hydroxide ion. For E2, I need a bulkier strong base greater than or equal to hydroxide ion. No anions for SN1, any anion base for E1. We're still sort of ranking here in primary, and I know that this says bulkier strong base greater than or equal to hydroxide. This says definitely weaker than hydroxide, and I'm at hydroxide. This is leaning towards E2. So as I come up here, this base is hydroxide, and that is leaning towards E2. And so I've got things everywhere. I've got just a mess of stuff over here. High temperatures. When I go back and I look at what high temperature ranks towards temp, what I see is that high temp leans towards elimination, low temp leads towards SN2 or leans towards. So this high temp here is leaning towards elimination. So we'll go over here and we'll say, oop, this one was high. This is leaning towards elimination reaction. And because I was versus SN2 versus E2, I'm sort of leaning towards E2. And all of a sudden now, I'm just confused as all get out. And this is the problem with these sorts of reactions. The SN1, SN2, E1, E2, there's so much information and so much that I need to balance. And how do I balance it all? And what do I do with this mess of information now that just seems overwhelming? And there's no way that I could possibly come up with a decision or do this. Well, we're going to rely on the magic sheet. And while we look at a number of these different things, a number of different factors, we had a hierarchy that we set. The hierarchy that we set was that substrate, then the base nucleophile, then we hit solvent and temperature. And I feel like I'm forgetting, oh, leaving group. Leaving group kind of fit in here with the base and nucleophile. And we said that this was number one, These guys together were number two. Solvent was number three. Temperature was number four. In terms of priority, but this can change with factors. And so this is not a hard set rule. So while normally I want to go with substrate, and my substrate is telling me that this should be an SN2 reaction, what I really have in here when I look at the magic sheet is that when I look at the base versus nucleophile, hydroxide is a base. It's not really a good nucleophile. And so what I have in here happens to be a base, which leans towards E2. My leaving group is not helping me decide. My leaving group is saying E2, SN2, it's saying E1, it's saying SN1, and that there's no real good indication in the leaving group. And so I'm going to ignore the leaving group for the most part right now. My solvent was polar, and the solvent was helping me towards SN2 and E2. And my temperature was high relative to my tosylate. Relative to tosylate leaving group. And so when I look at all of those things, what jumps out at me as being really relevant and important is the fact that I don't have a nucleophile, that what I really have is a base. And so I see that E2 reaction there. My leaving group is okay for E2 reaction. My solvent is okay for E2 reaction. My temperature is high, and that high temperature generally points towards an E2 favorable mechanism. Points towards elimination. And so what I'm seeing is I'm seeing E2 jumping out at me. And secondarily, what I'm seeing is I'm seeing SN2 sort of showing up as a less important factor in here. And so leaning towards E2 over SN2, as the E2 being major and the SN2 being minor. Now what we need to do is we need to go back to the actual reaction. We'll put it down here. And what we need to do is we need to get the major and minor components. Major E2 and minor SN2, and draw out both of those products and what those products are going to look like. So after going through and doing all of that work, can we now figure out what the E2 reaction looks like for this substrate? And can we figure out what the SN2 looks like for this substrate? So both of these mechanisms, when we go through and we look at the E2 reaction, E2 requires the pulling of a proton anti-periplanar to the leaving group. So if we take the tosylate here and we look at where the protons are that we need to pull, these two protons are the ones that are going to be pulled anti to the leaving group in order to kick it out. And because it's on a primary center, the leaving group is on a primary center. There's no geometry of the double bond to worry about. We can simply use a base the hydroxide, maybe since that's our actual base, to pull this proton, to kick the electrons in, to kick out the leaving group. And that takes us towards the E2 product. The SN2 product is going to have that substrate displaced by the incoming nucleophile hydroxide ion in an SN2 reaction where we kick out the tosylate. Leading towards the alcohol. And so here now, we have the answers to this problem. I really don't want my E2 in there. I gotta get this guy, drop this guy back down. We have the answers to the first problem. That gives me E2 major and SN2 minor. And our reasoning there pretty much is that hydroxide ion is a base. It's not a good nucleophile. We have an aprotic solvent, which is good for E2 and SN2. We have high heat. And a good leaving group. And that is what is promoting this reaction to be E2 major. Okay, let me stop and open it up for questions and see what you guys think about that first problem. The first one is always confusing. The number of factors that we're trying to absorb is a lot. And I know that it can get confusing. But as we go through more and more examples, it starts to get easier and we stop writing as much information and we start to get a better feel and intuition for each one of the problems. So hopefully that's helping a little bit in breaking it down. Okay, Kylie, that's working for you. How about everybody else? Let me jump back and just check and see if I can see the screen over here. Okay, I'm seeing a bunch of thumbs up, so that's working. Okay, no real questions on that first one? Okay, if there's no questions on the first one, then let's maybe jump to the second problem on the list that I want to look at.
Can I ask a super quick question?
Please, go for it.
When you went back up to like, deciding between like the SN2 or E2 like being major, it was just like a little confusing to me because like just the way that you ordered the priority, if I was doing this on my own, I feel like I would have been leaning more towards SN2 just because it's the first one. So I'm just like wondering like how difficult that's going to be to determine like on my own, like during the test or something like that.
Yeah, Kylie, that's a great question. And I think that that's really why that's really why I wrote this.
Right.
Is okay. That this is not a hard ranking. And that if you go with the ranking just as it is, and putting substrate of being the most important thing, then it can lead you in the wrong direction.
Okay.
And
you're saying that the base like the fact that it's not a nucleophile and that it's a base instead,
yeah,
is important in determining that it's more E2, right?
Exactly. So what happened here was two things that combined together that made the SN2 reaction get decreased. Number one is the fact that hydroxide is a really strong base. And that within all of these, when we look at SN2, in order to be a good SN2, we usually like to see a weaker base than hydroxide. That's not to be that hydroxide can't undergo the SN2 reaction. It's just that hydroxide tends to be more of a base than it does a nucleophile. The other thing combined with that was the high heat, that here an SN2, it needs to be low or lower, and that higher heats will promote the E2. So when I took the high heat in combination with the hydroxide, it overwhelmed the nature of the primary substrate. And those two things became more important and moved it more towards elimination. Okay. So it's the combination of factors. It's not any one particular factor there. It was the high heat in combination with hydroxide that really pushed it towards elimination and made those two things more important than the primary substrate. If the temperature had been lower, had I done something more along room temperature, now I start thinking, well, maybe I'm moving more towards SN2. Or if I did this at 0 degrees C, maybe I'm moving more towards SN2. Still, because of hydroxide, I would have had a high amount of E2, but I might have started pushing more towards SN2 with the lower heat had I not had two factors pushing towards E2.
So the priority is like something I should factor in after I like get everything, like decide where things make me lean first.
Yeah.
Bring priority in like a little bit later.
I think that I have a hard time myself quantifying it and saying how much to put on the prioritizations. And maybe almost it's a fault to even give a prioritization, and that to try to just look at all the factors and see where the factors point, and that you start to develop an intuition. And I think that that intuition comes from looking at a large number of examples and trying to develop that intuition there. And so I think that I'm going to have a very difficult time fully answering your question until we see enough examples that you start to get a bit of an intuition, and then maybe we can have this conversation again. Okay. After we see some more examples.
I also have like one other question. Sorry. Please. When we were deciding, like the first one was the substrate is number like priority one or whatever. Right. When actually back on your magic sheet that you were
just. Oh, okay. Sorry.
When we decided that it was leaning towards SN2 with the like 1 degree.
Yes.
How come it's not like the other two that you highlighted? Like, cause it looks like it's on E2 as well. So I was just like,
but when we look at it, that's a good question. Actually, let me turn this around. So when we're looking at these, it is on the E2, but it's the slowest on the E2. That primary substrates, because of, well, let me do this. When we look at an E2 reaction,
it just makes me feel like it still applies to the E2. You know what I mean? Like we were talking about it leaning towards E2, and I felt like it didn't completely discount E2 when we like decided. I don't know.
It does not. You are correct. But the difference between an E2 and an SN2. An SN2 is exothermic. And E2 is generally endo. And what that means is that the transition state is linked to the developing product, whereas the transition state over here is linked to the substrate. And that when we look at an E2, that remember the stability of double bonds goes in order of the substitution of the double bond. And so when we're at a primary leaving group and we're making a primary double bond, if I do it like this, or even if we take it out to extend it to make it look like our material that we're actually working with, and that this is monosubstituted. The double bond is fairly unstable, or I shouldn't say that. The double bond is plenty stable. It's just not as stable when I look at a monosubstituted. I'm here on my list of being more stable. And because of that, that raises my activation energy along with this chemical reaction. And so when I'm looking at these rates that are telling me that tertiary is the fastest, secondary, then primary is the slowest, primary is the slowest because the double bond is less stable than I would get at a secondary or tertiary leaving group, which would lead me to these more substituted, that would lead me to these more substituted products that would bring down the activation energy for these. So primary is the slowest because it's the less of stable of the double bonds, thereby raising the activation energy for this. And so, yeah, it's on there and it doesn't discount it. But what we need to do is think relative rates as well, that those relative rates that we went over on Wednesday are all sort of playing factor into this. And so just because something is on the sheet, you need to look at its position on the sheet and what it's telling you to the relative rate of its position on the sheet.
Okay.
Does that help a little bit, Kylie?
Yeah, no, definitely.
Okay. All right. Let me take the next problem. And let's look at the next problem. Let's see how much space I have. Oh, I've eaten up all of this. So what I want to do is, I can bring it into the notes again. So I'm going to import this again so that we can do it on an all new problem. And that should drop it in here. Yeah, so we've got it again. And I need to create a page after this so I've got someplace to write. And let's put our next problem in. And all of these problems are going to challenge you to think in ways that you haven't before. Because there are all of a sudden so many factors that are at play in these that they're just, it's challenging to keep everything in mind. Okay, so let me pause for a second as we're looking at this problem too. And let me try to put this into perspective. Organic chemistry is one of the classes that medical schools look at more than any other class. They look at this because, primarily because of this section that we're in right now, the SN1, E1, SN2, E2 reaction set has substrate, base, nucleophile, leaving group, solvent, and temperature. Those are six factors. Those six factors have no clear hierarchy or prioritization. And not only that, you have to think about sterics, electronics, all the different possible leaving groups. You have to think of stereochemistry and double bond energy stabilization. All of these balls need to be kept in the air all at the same time. And it mirrors to a degree a patient walking in to your office that has five different symptoms and maybe even some symptoms that they don't realize that they have, and a panel of blood work that's been done and some other tests. And you have to take all of that information and think about all the different possible diseases that it could be and figure out what all that information is telling you. When all of that information may be pointing in different directions and be not cohesive, but maybe in conflict in some cases. And how do you take all of that information? Oh, I apologize for my dogs. How do you take all that information and put it together into something that makes sense and come up with the right answer and diagnose the patient and help them? That's kind of what we're doing here. And it takes time and study and intuition and an intimate knowledge of all of those things, and how well you can balance all of those factors is what med school is sort of looking at. It's your ability to handle chaos and make sense out of the chaos. And it's not that you can't do it. It's that it takes time to develop it. And so at first, it's extraordinarily difficult and challenging. And where do I look and how do I do this? It comes in the resiliency of not giving up and to seeing as many different examples as you can and having somebody help you walk through it in how you tackle it. And so that's what we're going to keep doing. And so I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you where you have to take all of those things in it and work with them. And like I said, it's just going to be time and practice, which is why I've ditched the rest of the lab stuff that we might be doing and just dedicate lab, because this is time where we can actually sit down and go through these and study it. So I don't want to discourage anybody or dissuade you, but I want you to also understand why it may be challenging and why it may be difficult, and to not give up, because it's worth putting in the time and effort to master in order to do it. And it's going to take us forward in the class and all the rest of the things that we're going to do. And this is, while it is the most challenging material that you have probably ever wrestled with, and it's the most challenging material that we've done in OCHEM, material does get more difficult than this as you go forward. It's just that if you can handle this level of complexity, you can handle any level of complexity. And it just takes time and patience. And there's not a single one of you that can't do this. It just takes time and practice. That's all. I say that not to discourage you. I say that if you're feeling that this is difficult and overwhelming, that is natural and that is appropriate response for what you were seeing. It just takes time and patience to get beyond that and to master it and not give up. But I have faith that absolutely every single one of you can do this. So that's my pep talk. Okay, let's break this one down. What type of substrate do we have? How would we classify this? Is this primary, secondary, or tertiary? Remember, you've got the chat, and all you got to hit is 1, 2, or 3. Primary. When we look at it, where is the leaving group and what type of, and maybe it helps to see sort of a reminder that when we look at substrates and the leaving group is out on something that has two hydrogens on it, this is what we call primary. When we look at a leaving group that is on a carbon that has one hydrogen on it, this is what we call secondary. And when we look at a leaving group that is on a carbon that doesn't have any hydrogens on it, this is what we call tertiary. Another way to think about that is not in terms of hydrogens, but to look at it in terms of, all right, this is connected to a carbon that has one other carbon connected to it. This is connected to a carbon that has two carbons connected to it. This is connected to a carbon that has three carbons connected to it. And that really is where primary, secondary, tertiary comes from, is how many carbons are connected to the carbon where the leaving group is connected. So how would we classify this substrate that we're on right now? Is it primary, secondary, or tertiary? Primary. Thank you. Ying. Okay. This is primary. So classifying this, this is where my leaving group is connected, and it is connected to only one other carbon. And so this is absolutely a primary substrate. So my substrate for this is a primary substrate. My leaving group is a chloride. So what we'll do, we'll box that in. My leaving group here is a chloride. And so we'll come and we'll classify the leaving group in a minute. So that's my leaving group sitting out here. This guy, OCH3 minus, this is my base or nucleophile, and I need to decide whether it's a base or a nucleophile. So my, I've got to keep switching inks here. Base nucleophile here is methoxide ion. So we'll come back and we'll rank that in a minute. My solvent is methanol. And my temp is 25 degrees C. Okay, so we got to rank all these things in terms of what they're showing me. What are they promoting? Let's go look at chloride and see where chloride is in terms of our leaving groups. Leaving group was up here. And leaving group in terms of chloride puts me, for all of them, they're all the same. So they all have the same hierarchy in terms of leaving group. Chloride is the weakest of my leaving groups. It would rank sort of as an okay leaving group. Let's see if I have classifications of nucleophiles. I don't have any other thing that's going to tell me that. So I wouldn't put this as a poor leaving group, but I wouldn't put it as a good leaving group either. I would sort of put this as an okay leaving group is the way that I would rank chloride. And in terms of leaving groups, a good leaving group equals a weak base. Well, chloride is a pretty weak base, but it's not as weak as bromide or iodide or tosylate. Those are weaker bases. And so where I think about this, usually what we say is OTS is a better leaving group than iodide, is a better leaving group than bromide, is a better leaving group than chloride, that these are going in terms of the strength of the conjugate base, that the weaker the base, the better the leaving group. And so I have an okay leaving group, but it's not a great leaving group because it's lowest on my list here in terms of leaving groups. And I don't know what that's promoting yet. Solvent. And like I said, I just keep bouncing around. I just, whatever catches my eye and what I can do easily. And then I come back and I sort of rank other things. Or maybe instead of solvent, maybe we should rank temperature now because we've ranked the leaving group. And remember that the temp is whether it's high versus low is proportional to the leaving group. So if I have a really good leaving group, then I'm in that situation where I have a very weak bond and that paddle ball sort of idea that if I just breathe on this thing wrong, that the bond can break. And so with my leaving group being an okay leaving group and this temp being 25 degrees, this seems to me that I'm in this sort of paddle ball picture. Where is that paddle ball picture? Oh my God, I lost it. There we go. Then I'm in this sort of paddle ball picture. It's not a poor leaving group, but it's not the best leaving group. And so I've got a fairly strong string here. I don't have poor, I've got okay, but this 25 degrees C to me now is seeming relatively low. And so this is looking like a pretty low temperature. So this temperature is feeling kind of low. Now we can do solvent. Solvent, this solvent here, that's a hydrogen connected to an oxygen. This is a hydrogen bonding solvent. So as an H bonding solvent, this solvent is classified as polar protic. And methoxide ion, I haven't classified yet. So now that we've done all those things, now we can go to our magic sheet and sort of see what the magic sheet is telling us about each one of these items. First off, we have a primary substrate. So the primary substrate leans me towards SN2. So here's my primary substrate. Substrate is leaning me towards SN2. So I'm going to go and I'm going to write down SN2 for that primary substrate. That's where that's leaning. My leaving group, chloride, doesn't help me to decide where this is going. So I'm going to ignore the chloride for the moment. The solvent, what do I have yet? Solvent, polar protic. Let's see what polar protic does. Methanol. The solvent here, being methanol, goes towards SN1 and E1. And when I come up and I look on the sheet up here, and I look under solvent, I see polar aprotic, polar aprotic, polar protic, polar protic. That this leans towards SN1 and E1. Actually, I'm going to change colors as I do this so that we know sort of each thing. So let's make solvent green. Polar protic, these are leaning towards SN1 and E1. So when I come down here, my solvent is promoting SN1 and E1 as a polar protic solvent. And let's now, we've already decided the relatively low temp, but we didn't decide what the relatively low temp is telling us. So let's go look at temperature. Temperature, which we did in blue, low temp. These low temperatures tend to promote substitution as opposed to elimination. And so I'm thinking sort of SN1, SN2 based on my temperature. So when I'm down here, temperature, this is telling me SN1, SN2, that those are substitution sorts of temperatures. And now let's deal with that methoxide ion. Let's come over here and see if we can find methoxide ion. Methoxide ion is, we need a new color. Let's maybe do it pink. That is not a highlighter. Methoxide ion sits here. That this is really R connected to an oxygen with a negative charge. And that is my CH3O- that is methoxide ion. This is sitting at a good nucleophile. And when I look at its nucleophilicity in where it sits, the nucleophilicity number, this is a list, a table that is in increasing order of nucleophilicity. These are better nucleophiles. So in terms of good nucleophile, where does that tell me over here? Well, I need a good nucleophile, and this is a good nucleophile. But when I look at what methoxide is, methoxide, in terms of a nucleophile, OCH3- is about on par approximately equal to hydroxide. In terms of its base versus nucleophile. It is a good nucleophile. But when I look at it, one of the things here is it says weaker base than hydroxide, and this one says strong base approximately equal to hydroxide. It discounts no anions. It doesn't discount E1. It says any anionic base there. So this is a possibility. But when I look at this, it's really leaning towards sort of this E2, but it could also be SN2. It could also be E1. But I think the strongest is really E2 because of it's equal to hydroxide. So when I come back down here now and I'm looking at this, this guy is really saying E2, but it doesn't discount SN2 or E1, SN1 is discounted, E1. Okay, so now we've sort of ranked everything. And when I look at all these rankings again, this is looking rather confusing, that when I look at all of these different factors, they're all pointing in different directions. And there's no super clear indication of which direction to go. So how do I synthesize all this and put all this together? Well, primary leaving groups, I'm going to fall back on my prioritization that substrate is of most importance most of the time. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, all right, this SN2 on substrate is a pretty important thing. SN2 is not discounted here. SN2 is not in my solvent, but I'm going to save on that for a second. SN2 is also here. One of the things that was told to me about SN1, when I look at SN1, is that no anions. I need a weak nucleophile. I definitely do not have a weak nucleophile. This is definitely sort of like off the table because of my nucleophile. And so when I come back down in this list and I'm looking at this list, this guy was off the table because of this. SN1 was off the table. SN1 is off the table because of my base nucleophile. So if I take SN1 off the table and I look at my temp being low, which is promoting SN2 over the eliminations, all of a sudden things start to come sort of back into color. I'm seeing SN2 as being really important, and it's showing up there. It's showing up there. It's showing up there because of my low temperature. And so my substrate is telling me SN2. My nucleophile is telling me SN2. My temp is telling me SN2. That all of those factors, once the SN1 was taken off the table, that low temperature took elimination off the table, and it sort of coalesced around SN2. And that's that sort of intuition and readjusting of hierarchy, that what really helped me here were these two things. It was substrate and it was temperature. And the nucleophile fell in as being the secondary sort of factor that pointed towards SN2 that just sort of clinched it. That's what happened there. So let's take this and draw this out. And oh, and when I was in SN2, the competing reaction, what reaction competes with SN2? We need to think about the competing reaction that's going to compete with this. It would be this nucleophile that, because it was so strong, also has a strong base, that the elimination is what is going to compete with this. So this is going to have a major SN2 with an E2 competing reaction. So let's draw this out.
Jason?
Please, go for it.
How can you tell when you're going to be using your reactant as a base or a nucleophile?
Yeah, that's that is so hard. I'm trying to see where I have it in the example. I don't have it in the example. Colin, the answer to that question, there are so many different bases and so many different nucleophiles that I can compare to. Normally what we say is that it has to do partially with hydroxide, but also with sterics. So how do I do this? Let's do this. Let's make this sort of a dividing line, but it's a fuzzy dividing line. It's not a strong dividing line. Stronger base tends to be over here that it's going to function as a base. Weaker in a pKa sense, these tend to function as nucleophiles. There are some things like potassium tert-butoxide that these things we call a bulky base, and they almost never function as a nucleophile because of how bulky they are and how strong a base they are. There are other things that are out here that are like this guy, lithium diisopropyl amide. This is called LDA, that its job is to function as a bulky base. And because of that, these things are locked in as a base. There are other things that are on par with hydroxide that are methoxide ion or ethoxide ion. These things could go either way at the dividing line. So hydroxide, methoxide, ethoxide, these can go either way. And that we look at the temp more to make a judgment here, that if the temp is high, then these that are on the dividing line will go towards a base. If the temp is low, then those things on the dividing line will go towards a nucleophile. And so we can see hydroxide, we can see methoxide, we can see ethoxide move towards a nucleophile under low temperature conditions. Under high temperature conditions, they'll react more as a base. Other things that are weaker sort of nucleophiles, we can think of things like acetate anion or HS minus or I'm trying to think about some other, we'll see a lot of other different sorts of nucleophiles. Bromide minus is a pretty good one, or iodide minus. So that while I look at the pKa table and I can go back to the pKa table in terms of base looks versus nucleophile, for those things that are on the fence, it comes down to temperature. And then I have some things which are almost always nucleophiles and some things which are almost always bases, but that can change too. For instance, when I look at SN1, SN1 here tells me no anions, any anion in the presence of a carbocation will undergo elimination. And so even something that is a very weak base, if I throw it in with a carbocation, it's going to go elimination. And so even those things that are really weak bases can sometimes function as a base in the presence of a carbocation. So what I'm saying is it's challenging. And I think it's going to take some of those examples and me showing you some of those examples to start to hit it home a little bit. So hang on to that, Colin. It's not an easy question to answer. I think I've answered part of it, but I haven't answered all of it. And my hesitancy is that when I answer part of a question, it leads you to make a mistake because you have a false sense of security that you've gotten the whole answer. You've gotten a good answer in this, but you don't have the whole answer yet. So it doesn't all hang on this just yet. What is written just before Bokki base? Oh, the potassium terbutoxide. These are different structural. Wait, Dina, are you asking here on the page that I'm on now, or are you asking up here?
The last one.
The black one?
Yeah, the one with the underline. What is that after the oxygen?
Oh, BU. BU? It is a B and a U, butyl.
Okay, and is that a plus sign above the oxygen as well?
Let me draw it bigger.
Thank you.
Potassium O tertiary butoxide. This equals O connected to a tertiary butyl group, and the potassium is the counter ion. Mm. So this is a tertiary butyl group.
Oh, so that's what that T represents.
Butyl. We're grabbing the T and the BU to make that T and BU there. And that is the tertiary butyl. That's what that's standing for.
Okay.
The LDA is lithium diisopropyl amide. And that is the LDA. And that is this one that has the negative charge, and the lithium is the counter, and that's what we write as LDA, lithium diisopropyl amide. So those are those two Bokki bases. They're Bokki because of the steric bulk that we're thinking about out here. These groups make them Bokki bases, and they almost cannot function as a nucleophile. It is really just about a Bokki base. Finley, you are so inconsolable today, buddy. You need to calm down. I need to go put some classical music on for my dogs at some point. I'll do that before lecture. Okay. We need to finish out this problem. So let's take this problem. And let's put it here. And we said that this was going to be a major SN2. With a minor E2. Okay, so once we figure that out, then it's up to going back to and doing the mechanism for each of those reactions to make sure that we get to the right product. So we want to think through the mechanism. It's not enough just to get that. We got to think, all right, what do I need to do now? Ooh, that is not what I wanted. I didn't want to have to redraw that again. In an SN2, we have the O-methoxide coming in and doing an SN2 reaction, backside attack, knocking out the leaving group. Oh, I am so sorry. Let me do one thing here and see if I can quiet them down for a second. Hang on.
Why are you guys constantly walking? What are you doing? Quiet it down. Close the door.
All right. They must be hearing some ground crew outside, or somebody's got a leaf blower going and they're like freaking out, but it's like five houses down and I can barely hear it. So can you see the dog? Yeah, I'll bring him in at the end of lab. I'll show him to you guys. Okay. So, so when we do this reaction, this is the SN2 part. When we go through and do this, you have to be careful of that stereocenter because the reaction is not happening at the stereocenter. The stereocenter stays intact. The stereocenter is sitting on this carbon. That is my stereocenter where my hydrogen is back. But the reaction is occurring at this center. And so the stereocenter stays intact. The stereocenter does not change because the SN2 reaction did not happen at the stereocenter. That is the SN2 product. So we'll draw that product up here as our major SN2 and different forms of representation. So that would be the major product. And now I need to look at the elimination and that E2 pulling the proton and kicking out the leaving group. And so I need to find a proton, which is, these would be alpha, this position would be beta, and I need to find the proton, which is beta to the leaving group. So in an E2, I'm looking for a hydrogen beta to the leaving group, and there's only one, and I'm going to pull that with the methoxide ion, dumping the electrons in, kicking out the leaving group, and that's going to make a double bond, and that double bond now is trigonal planar, and the trigonal planar nature of that gets rid of the stereocenter. So that's my E2. And so I have my major and my minor product. And like math class, let's box this in. So that was my final answer and my major reaction there. And what really fell into this that led me in this way was the primary substrate. The low temp, the leaving group, not as good as the tosylate, so just an okay leaving group, and a good nucleophile. So those are the things that really fed into it, that helped make my decision that this was really going to be primarily an SN2 rather than an E2. Okay? Everybody good with this example? Should we move on to another one?
Can I ask a question, I guess?
Please.
When you go to like your magic page thing,
yeah.
When we like discounted the fact that like we just like completely like crossed out this one because of the nucleophile.
Yes.
I'm just a little bit confused. Like when do we like completely cross something out? Because in this one, I think it was like the difference between like aprotic, polar aprotic, and then polar protic.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. So I just want to know like when something completely doesn't even come into the equation anymore.
Okay. Kylie, that's a great question. And what it's hard to completely cross something off. Completely crossing something off is generally not something I try to do. However, with SN1, I can completely cross something off because of this no anions issue. When I have an anion as a nucleophile or a base, and I have a carbocation, it almost always goes towards elimination. And so this no anions thing says that when I have an anion, it pushes it towards the E1. And so if there are anions, I can pretty much cross off SN1. That's not true all the time, but I try to stick with that to give you something that's concrete. So I almost never give you an SN1 where there's anions present, because it's just totally uncool. It's not to say that it can't happen, but that's really unusual that normally those get kicked up to E1 types of reactions rather than SN1. Your question of solvent. When I look at solvent, so I'm here, solvent, polar aprotic, polar aprotic. These solvents need polar protic, and I was clearly in polar protic, so why didn't I cross these off because of solvent? Mm-hmm. Remember that solvent doesn't always influence the bimolecular ones as much as it influences the unimolecular ones. And so if I have a polar aprotic solvent that doesn't allow for carbocation formation, then I can cross off the carbocation formation because it's not going to support it. Whereas if I have a solvent that supports ionization, that doesn't discount me going the other way. So what I would say is that if I have a solvent, how do I do this? I've never tried to do this before. If I have a solvent that is polar aprotic, that the polar aprotic throws me up into that category. And it sort of blocks off these reactions here because it doesn't promote ionization. What happens is the carbocation is not supported in that polar aprotic solvent. However, if I have a polar protic solvent, the polar protic solvent can also function for the SN2 and E2 ones. It's a solvent of convenience. In other words, when I look at doing a reaction of methoxide ion, it's very easy to make methoxide ion from methanol. And when I want to use ethoxide ion, it's very easy to make ethoxide ion from ethanol. These solvents I call solvents of convenience. It's because I can take methanol and throw in sodium metal, and I generate sodium methoxide. Plus I get some hydrogen gas that goes off, and it's how I make it. Same thing, I can take ethanol and throw in some sodium metal or potassium metal, and I make sodium ethoxide plus hydrogen gas, and it's how I make the sodium ethoxide and the sodium methoxide. It's just a solvent of convenience to be able to make the reagent. Whereas if I want to put NaOET into THF, a different solvent, I have to make the sodium ethoxide, isolate it, put it in THF. It's just a whole lot harder to do. And so these solvents being polar protic versus this solvent being polar aprotic, My brain is ceasing to function. Aprotic. Sometimes the choice of solvent is one of convenience, and not trying to tell you which reaction that you're going to do. Because when we looked at, and I'm trying to think of where I did it. I'll just do it again. I'll just do it here. That when we have, the SN2 reaction, nucleophile coming in and hitting the carbon, and the leaving group being kicked out, that this transition state was a nonpolar transition state. This is nonpolar. And because of this, well, and let's look at the SN1, E1, because they have the same transition state. Here, what I have is the developing carbocation as the leaving group is coming off, that this thing is becoming trigonal planar and developing the carbocation, and that this is a polar transition state. That the polar transition state requires the strong polar protic solvents in order to solvate this appropriately. And so this really requires polar protic and strongly affected by solvent. Whereas over here, because of the polar protic, or because of the nonpolar nature of this, the nonpolar nature says that this is promoted. Actually, I'm not even going to say it promoted. Yeah, let's say promoted. Promoted by polar solvents. But not, but less affected by solvent than the other. Meaning that polar aprotic, the rate goes faster than protic, but protic is not excluded. So that's why I'm not counting that off on the magic sheet or just crossing something off based on solvent when I was looking at that. I think that's the answer to the question that you're looking for, Kylie.
Yeah, I just felt like when we cross something off, it feels like so much more like black and white and everything seems kind of gray. So
everything's gray. Everything's so gray.
Like wondering, like, it seems like for solvent, it seemed like it was gray because you didn't cross it off. But I was just wondering if there's anything else that's like more black and white.
Yeah, I don't have anything that's more. So the only things that tend to be black and white are the bulky bases, which are always bases and count other things off. Anytime you have an anion present, it knocks out SN1. And I think those are the only two main things that are black and white.
Okay.
And that everything else is gray.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
And then it seems like also on the what you're on right now, the page that you're on right now.
Yeah.
You're saying the solvent is more affected on the right side, right?
Solvent is much more affected on the right-hand side. I don't like to say it's black and white and that I can cross things off, but
it is a little bit more like affected.
It's much more affected. So the SN1 and E1s really, really need that polar protic solvent to help them, to help that reaction go. And that if you don't have that, And so what happens is if I have a polar aprotic solvent So if I have polar aprotic solvent, then I tend to cross off SN1E1. But if I have a polar protic solvent, then the polar protic solvent tells me that this is still okay.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's finding new ways to make the information accessible to you, particularly in this online format. And how do I explain those? That's the best way we can do it. And I'm sorry that there's not a concise, cohesive way to put all this information together. I think that's what I've tried to do with the magic sheet. And that's really what the purpose of the magic sheet is. It's really teaching you how to interpret the magic sheet that is important, because the magic sheet isn't magic in its own. The magic sheet is only magic when you understand it. So it's really you that becomes magic, not the magic sheet.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of like solubility rules and stuff. It's like,
it is.
It's yeah. Like blah, 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 and then like exception. Also, here's another exception. And here's something I didn't mention. And so it's like, it's chemistry. So like, I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, and that's neat that you say that in terms of solubility, because if I go back to Chem 3 and where did I do solubility with Chem 3? Here. These are my solubility rules for Chem 3. And you're exactly right that in solubility rules, you had the exceptions. And so you had to remember where those exceptions were. And in Chem 3, it was all about information processing, that the way that I always process that was a red light, green light, yellow light sort of way. Green light, always soluble. Yellow light, use caution. If it's paired with red, then it precipitates. And red light, stop, that these are going to precipitate unless it's paired with a green light. So it was sort of red light, green light analogy in trying to make information accessible and tangible. And you're right, it's those exceptions that you needed to watch for. And we're trying to do the same thing in a much bigger scope with the reactions that we're doing right now.
Right. So, I'm just like, where's the red light and green light?
Exactly. Where is it? How do I make that approachable? And to me, the SN1, SN2, E1, E2 just became too big to kind of bring that together in that sort of cohesive way. And maybe I could do it, but it would be a much bigger piece of information.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good to know. I appreciate the explanation. I just wanted more clarity and I got.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. What time? 10:45. Let's try to see if we can fit one more in and we'll see if we can go through it a little bit faster because we're going to do more of these in lecture two. And then come Wednesday, we'll do more of them again. All right, let's take, and I'm going to email out a practice sheet that has these on it. I'm working off the practice sheet right now, but there's plenty of them on this practice sheet for you guys to work with, and I'll email out the answer key to it as well. So you guys will have all of that. Okay. Substrate. Primary, secondary, tertiary, what are we at? Can you guys rank this one? Tertiary, cool, okay, good. So this is a tertiary substrate. my leaving group while I'm there equals a bromide. This is a pretty good leaving group. Second only to the tosylates. So that's a good leaving group. My nucleophile base. This is missing. What the heck? There's no base or nucleophile. My solvent would be classified here as polar protic. And my heat temp is high. As soon as I see that symbol, we know that that equals high. So things that the magic sheet would tell me, this high temperature tends to promote elimination. So as soon as I see a high temperature, this is elimination. And so I'm E1, E2. The polar protic solvent, this is promoting SN1, E1, because I'm looking at carbocation formation. The fact that there is no base or nucleophile is telling me that the solvent, the ETOH, is the nucleophile. And that this is a sulvolysis reaction. And that is really inherently an SN1 process. The tertiary substrate up here is also leaning me towards SN1, E1, but does not exclude E2. E2, in order to have an E2, I would need a strong base. So the fact that the E2 is sort of like off the table because I don't have a strong base, because that's not in my mixture. And so really what I'm looking at is SN1 versus E1. And the difference between an SN1 and an E1 have to do with SN1 versus E1. Let's go get the magic sheet one more time. Let's bring this back in. And the other ones are all marked up, so I'll airdrop it in again. Okay, let's look at SN1 versus E1. In an SN1 versus E1, that I've come down to this decision that I'm here. The temp is high, yes, and so that sort of like ticks it into the E1 category. They're both tertiary. They both have polar aprotic solvent. They both have bromide in the same location. I am currently at a high temperature. So the high temperature is over here. That's really promoting that. But what's important here is that there's a weak nucleophile and particularly no anions. This is a really important factor, that any anionic base pushes me towards the E1. And so when I'm looking E1 versus SN1, yes, temperature is a component, but if there's no anion, it tends to go SN1. If there is an anion, it goes E1. So the difference between them really is any anion, it's going to go SN1. Excuse me. Oh, I just made that mistake. Any anion is going to go E1. No anion, SN2, SN1. Oh, gosh, I should not be lecturing right now, apparently. And so the fact that we have no anion in this is really pushing me towards the SN1 reaction. So my decision gets made here that when I'm looking at all of this, it is the fact that that my base or nucleophile, that there really isn't a strong base or nucleophile, that there is no anion. And so that is really going to push me towards the SN1. And that is what the definition of the sulvolysis reaction is. That's where that's coming in at. So E1 is going to be my competing reaction, but it was this here and this guy that drove me towards SN1 that I'm recognizing this as an SN1. And so we can complete this now that my substrate, I've got to be able to see it again as I kicked it off the screen.
The ethanol couldn't act as an anionic base?
Ethanol doesn't have an anion in it. So the ethanol itself is just a polar protic solvent. If I draw it out, it has lone pairs, but there's no charge on it. That's different. When we say anion, anion is really meaning something like methoxide ion, where we have an anion, or it's meaning that I have some base in there that is something like sodium hydrogen carbonate, where I have the bicarbonate CO3 minus anion that's serving as a base, or maybe I have sodium acetate, AC, NA, should be NaOAC, that this is the acetate anion, that these are bases. And so as that base, I'm looking for the charge that is relevant in that. The other thing that's cluing me into that is these metal salts, that because I have a metal salt, that there is an anion that is present. But when I just draw the solvent as ethoxide, then there's no anion that's present in that chemical reaction. And that's going to go towards the SN1 reaction.
Okay.
So the SN1 reaction, what I need to be careful of in an SN1 reaction, I need to move these out of my way, is that the bromide is going to come off. And as the bromide comes off, I'm looking at the different protons that can get pulled. And so I can get a couple of different products coming out of this. I can get this product. That is not the product that I get. Where did that go? Yeah, no, that is it. Plus, I can also get a second product where I can get that guy. So out of my SN1 reactions, and I forgot to look, heat. This did have heat. So when it has heat, there may be multiple products that we can get, and we need to choose the right product out of this. And then those are both, damn it, Jason, I told you I shouldn't be lecturing right now. These are my E1s. My SN1 is where the ethanol comes in. You guys also aren't calling me on it. So I'm going to put it all on you guys. It's not my fault. It is my fault. I'm being a horrible teacher at the moment. Okay, so we have the substitution reaction where the solvent comes in and binds directly to the carbocation. We have the elimination reactions where we have two minor products coming out and the major being the SN1. And these would be really minor. And I'm almost sorry that I drew them at this point because there's no anion. Therefore, there's no base. So I'm going to get very little of those elimination products. And the major one is going to be the substitution. But what I wanted to say is, and I should write it in red, anytime we go through a carbocation, watch for shifts. Watch for 1,2 hydrides and 1,2 alkyl shifts. So that's an important component there that we got to watch for. Katrina, does the bromide pick up the hydrogen when doing the SN1 reaction? Yes, but when the bromide picks up that hydrogen, you end up with HBr. Actually, I wouldn't say that it's the bromide that picks it up. It's probably a methanol that picks it up because bromide, when it reacts with methanol or ethanol, O-E-T, it's going to produce the ethanol that is protonated. And that is going to be lower energy than having the hydrogen attached to the bromide. So really it's the methanol that is picking it up. But that creates another problem, is that you get a buildup of acid and there is no base to relieve the buildup of an acid, which shuts down this reaction. So without a base, without an anion that can soak up the protons, the acid builds up, you get a buildup of charge and a shutting down of this chemical reaction, which is the E1 chemical reaction, which is why it predominantly goes SN1. So that's a good question. Okay. We have lecture at 11:10. It is now 10:58. We did 3 problems in 2 hours or so. Not bad. They get faster as we go on. And I promised you guys I would show you my dogs. So I'm going to go grab the dogs. And then I propose that we take, if you don't want to see the dogs, you can log off at this point. We'll call it quits for now. Take a 10-minute break. And we'll pick it back up in lecture. And I'll go grab my dogs and they can say hi, but I'm going to stop the recording. And then we'll take a 10-minute break and I'll see you guys in lecture. All right, let me go grab the dogs.